This is Attack of the 20th Century. Thank you for joining us as we explore science fiction, fantasy, and horror films of the 20th century. I'm your host, Jeff.
And I'm your other host, Kim.
Welcome to episode 16, where we review Twice Told Tales from 1963. Look for us on Instagram and Facebook at Attack of the 20th Century, that's 20th. We post our next movie selections there. You can comment, give your thoughts, and they just might make it on the air. All right, well, this past week has been very exciting. We've had a lot going on, including the end of school for the year.
Yeah, for us, not for public and private schoolers in Florida, but for us.
We don't care about them, though. We homeschool.
Yeah, we're homeschoolers, so our children are not technically done with their school for the year, but they're done meeting with their group for the year. So, yeah, that was a big deal for us. I feel like we've been saying for like the past 3 weeks or maybe 4 weeks, I don't know how busy things are. And yeah. I just forget every year that April is a crazy busy season for us. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because typically we are wrapping up our like school year with the other homeschoolers. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, now that our kids are older, there's dances and performances to go to. And, you know, so yeah, we've been super busy with all those fun things.
Yeah.
But we did squeeze in. We squeezed in an extra movie, not just a podcast movie this week.
Yeah, HBO Max has that deal where they play movies that are in the theater at the same time they stream on HBO Max. But you only get a little window of time, like a month before they pull it. And so we came up to the night before they pulled the King Kong Godzilla movie.
Oh, it was the night before?
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
So we were pretty much at the 11th hour there and watched that. What did you think about it overall?
I don't know. I was not in love with that movie. I feel like that movie falls into a genre of movies in our modern times that the whole thing, the only description I could come up with. So last week when we talked about Invasion of the Body Snatchers, I was applauding the fact that that was kind of a fast-paced movie. And I think anybody that was watching King Kong versus Godzilla, or is it Godzilla versus King Kong? Whatever, those two guys. Mm-hmm. You would also say that's fast paced, mm-hmm. but it's different. And mm-hmm. I can't, it's like just a, you know, nearly 2 hours of shaky cam is what the modern version of that is.
Yeah.
And so there was good storytelling that was at a quicker pace than what would have been normal in 1956 for Invasion mm-hmm. of the Body Snatchers. Whereas King Kong and Godzilla, it felt like that dumb thing you used to do when you were a kid where you were like flapping your hands in your friend's face and you would say, mm-hmm. you know, you're running through a forest and then you hit a tree and they smack you in the forehead. You know what I'm talking about? So annoying, right?
Yeah.
I feel like watching a movie like that for me is like somebody's doing that running through a forest, hands flashing in my face. Like the mm-hmm. whole time I'm watching the movie, everything is just like so much shaky cam and there's a billion cities and buildings and things, just
right,
everything, there's so much destruction. It takes me out of the story of it.
Yeah You get desensitized after a while. You know, while we were watching it, we compared it to the ending of Man of Steel. So we really enjoyed Man of Steel, you know, with Henry Cavill and just that whole setup story explaining his you know, the creation of Superman, right Clark Kent to Superman. And it's all really done well, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the music helps and the slower paced storytelling helps.
Yeah.
But then in the last 20, 30 minutes, it turns into whatever the Godzilla King Kong movie is, where they're slamming each other around through several buildings and they're just, you know, it's just too much CGI punching you in the face.
Yeah. Wasn't it you that said, you know, all of these seem to boil down to an epic fist fight?
Right?
The fate of the world boils down to one big epic fist fight.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fine. I saw a lot of people commenting on the movie how, you know what you're getting into. They're not about the story. They're not about the character development. It's not about the creativity. It's really just about kind of that CGI
action.
You want
to see a giant lizard and a giant gorilla go at it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, okay.
And they did it.
I guess I should know that going into it.
Right.
And then I wouldn't have these feelings about it. If you like that sort of thing, go enjoy it. I'm not a big fan.
But yeah, one thing we did watch was the movie that we're reviewing today, Twice Told Tales.
Yeah.
And what's different about this versus some of the other things that we've watched is this is a collection of three different stories told mm-hmm. in one film. in this case, all of the works were based on Nathaniel Hawthorne's stories, short stories, actually two short stories and one novel. We'll get to that in a minute. But I thought for our fun question today, we could talk about what short story or collection of short stories would you like to see turned into a film, a la Twice Told Tales? Why don't you get us started this time?
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, I'm not huge into short stories. It's just not a genre that I like novels. And so I haven't, other than what I've had to study for school and teaching and whatnot, probably just don't have an extensive knowledge of short stories. But what I immediately thought of was our oldest son, when he was going through, it would have been eighth grade. We call that Challenge B in our programming. But they read through and studied a series of short stories and then wrote their own short stories. And they got to turn those, all of his classmates, they got to turn it into a published anthology. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So I would like to see some of those turned into some sort of movie or animation or... Mm-hmm. Just because I know those kids and,
yeah.
You know, they just came through my 10th grade class this year. So it would be pretty fun to see that. But one of the stories they read was by, I think his name's Anton Chekhov. Mm-hmm. It's called The Bet. And it was the story when our oldest was going through that class that stuck, the short story that stuck out to me the most. Because I was like, oh, this is kind of grim, you know?
Yeah.
And it's basically these two guys are having an argument about which is worse, the death penalty or life in prison. And so... You know, the rich banker guy, he's the one that's saying, you know, life in prison is worse. And the other guy's like, no, because living is better than death.
Right.
So they make a bet. And the younger guy agrees basically to lock himself up in this little, I don't know, it sounded like a little house on this guy's estate for 15 years. He can have no contact with anyone else. Like somebody kind of like slides him food under the door. They provide him with all the books he wants to read. But he's like solitary confinement for 15 years. And if he finishes the 15 years and never tries to escape, I think he wins like $2 million. It's something insane, you know? So anyhow, the end of the tale, I won't spoil it for anybody that wants to go and read it. It's kind of twisted, but interesting. But then as I went and pulled out the book to look up the story just to try and remember it, to talk about it. And I realized like, wait a minute. We've seen this story already adapted. And then I remembered it was a Twilight Zone episode. And I don't remember what the name of that episode was. It's not the exact same bet, but there's still a bet. And it's a younger kind of whippersnapper, runoff at the mouth guy debating with an older gentleman. And what was it? He couldn't talk for a year. I think this guy talked too much.
Right. They were in a country club and this guy always yapped all day, every day. And the older guy was like, I'll pay you X amount of dollars if you can be silent for a whole year.
Yeah.
You achieve that, then you can get this big fortune at the end
of
the year.
He wasn't like locked in a room or anything, right? Like
had to stay at the country club.
Oh, had to stay at the country club, but couldn't make a peep. Couldn't talk to anybody. Correct. People tried to talk to him, right?
Yeah.
And he could not respond or he would lose this money.
Mm-hmm.
And then, well, maybe I shouldn't spoil that either, is very similar to this other story. So I just thought, oh, wait, maybe Rod Serling was inspired by The Bet. I don't know.
Yeah.
Interesting.
That is a good one.
Yeah. Interesting concept. Makes you think, you know, and the ending, both of those stories have a twist ending that really do make you think. So
yeah.
I like that. Clearly, if I'm going to like a short story, and I would say anything by Arthur Conan Doyle, because I'm a huge Sherlock fan, but those have been adapted like ad nauseum, right?
Right.
We've seen that 100 million times. So if I were going to say any other short stories, I'd say maybe some Mark Twain short stories.
Oh, yeah.
He's like famous American short story writer, right?
Yeah.
I mean, of course we know his novels, but he also has just a plethora of short stories, and they're usually pretty funny. Like Mark Twain's great.
He's known for his wit.
Yeah, sarcasm and wit. I think we could turn that into like a, I don't know, an evening sitcom or something, right?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Short stories with Mark Twain comes on, I don't know, it could be like a PBS thing or something.
Yeah.
Every Sunday night you get one installment.
You wouldn't think they'd be too expensive to make either because they're all like real life, kind of country life. There's no technology or, I mean, it's just people talking and doing... you know, having something happen in town that's big and kind of people talking about
it. Or a frog that jumps and wins county fairs and stuff. That shouldn't be too hard to recreate, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, as you know, my favorite writer is Ray Bradbury.
Yes.
And he has several stories I would like to see in some sort of movie format. I think if we had a Twice Told Tales, but with a sci-fi spin on it. My favorite book of his is The Illustrated Man. Now that I've said it's my favorite book, I don't know, that's awfully big. But one of my favorite books is The Illustrated Man. And he has three stories in there I've selected. One is called The Man.
Okay.
And this is about these space explorers that kind of travel from planet to planet. And they come to find out that there is somebody who's been coming and doing like miracles on planet to planet. And, you know, it's a lot of it is them speculating, who is this person? Who's come? And they deduce that they think this is the second coming of the Messiah.
Oh.
So it's them actually searching him out, which I think was a kind of a cool, nifty concept. The next story is called The Fire Balloons. And kind of sticking with the religious theme, there's like a group of priests that travel to Mars to act as missionaries to the Martians.
Oh.
But when they get there, they find out the natives are just entities of pure energy. So they have thoughts, they have feelings, but they're mostly, they have no physical body.
Maybe that's what was in the sphere.
Oh, yeah. Don't bring up that movie, please.
Okay, sorry.
So it's them trying to, you know, figure out, do these people need redemption or not?
Oh.
You know, do they need to be saved if they don't have bodies and they don't have sin? You know, they don't have evil that's innate to them.
Interesting.
And then the last story I think I would adapt from there is called The Rocket. And it's about this old guy. He doesn't have much money, but he saves up his last bit of money to buy an old rocket that is immobile.
Oh.
And he sets it up for his kids, and they go out and they do daydreaming, or night dreaming, really, about adventures and stuff that they do. But it's a real sweet, intimate portrait of, you know, a man and his kids. You know, I really enjoyed that story growing up. So I thought, well, this would be a kind of a touching piece to kind of center it around there. So, you know, lots of cool ideas, good thoughts. I think these would be like a good selection of stories to put together for a movie.
I'm going to have to actually read some more Ray Bradbury because he seems to be a very deep thinker. All right, today we are going to be discussing Twice Told Tales, starring Vincent Price. This is a 1963 production from Sidney Salchow. Hopefully I'm pronouncing his name right. Just as a reminder, we are going to share spoilers. Because this is basically a movie told us three separate tales, we're going to kind of break them down tale by tale. So Jeff is going to kick us off on that. But before he gets started, I do want to mention, I looked up the Rotten Tomatoes score, and it looks like it's a 57% from the critics and 54% from the viewers. So that's pretty even. We don't always see a pretty even score.
Right. And it's available on Amazon Prime, which is one reason we picked it. We wanted to do Vincent Price film. And we looked out there. There's several available, actually. But this one was out there and it looked cool.
I do have something funny about this. Something I've noticed about these older movies, they don't really have a rating system like we're used to seeing now.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, usually when you look up a show that's running on Amazon Prime or something, it's going to tell you it's, you know, whatever its rating is, or it'll say so many new things that are coming out now are rated TV mature, right? Mm-hmm. Or MA or whatever it is, mature audiences. And we know that that includes pretty much a lot of stuff. Where you don't have those ratings because they didn't exist when this movie came out. But when you go to play it on Amazon Prime, it says, you know, in the little superscript up in the corner, like sexual overtones or
drug use,
violence,
profanity.
And all of that is so like not happening in these movies. I'm like, why?
It's barely PG, really.
Yeah. I mean, these could almost be G rated if it weren't for a little bit of creep factor.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's bizarre to me that Amazon or whoever tags them that way.
Yeah. And yeah. It was pretty comical.
I was like, drug use? What?
Yeah. And this was our first time watching the movie. So when we saw that, we thought, okay, what are we about to watch? And it was very mild.
Very mild, yes.
So I grew up watching Vincent Price in creepy movies, not really knowing the names of most of those films.
Yeah.
In the past year, we've watched a lot of his films, a few of them based on Edgar Allan Poe films, or stories like The Pit and the Pendulum.
Mm-hmm.
Tales of Terror, I just watched a few nights ago, which is also a similar, like, three short stories combined into one movie.
Right.
Comedy of Terrors and The Raven. And just to give you a little background, Twice Told Tales was originally a collection of stories that were printed in other publications. So magazines and newspapers. So they took all these individual stories and put them together, and that's where it got its name from, Twice Told Tales, because this is the second time they were being printed.
Okay.
So the first volume was published in the spring of 1837 and the second in 1842.
Oh, wow.
So this movie is comprised of three stories. Surprisingly, only one of them is in the actual Hawthorne's Twice Told Tales.
That's right.
And I don't know how you say that. Dr. Heidegger's experiment, right?
That works. That works for me.
That's the one. Rappaccini's Daughter and House of the Seven Gables is actually a novel.
That's its own novel. I think Rappaccini's Daughter is in Mosses from an Old Manse or Mosses of an Old Manse. I don't remember the exact wording, but it is another collection of Hawthorne stories.
Right, right. So why don't you tell us a little bit about Dr. Heidegger's experiment, and then we'll go through high fives and low points.
Well, so in this particular telling of Dr. Heidegger's experiment, we start with these two old guys who are clearly good friends, and they're having a drink in the evening. And one of the older men, the shorter, stouter one, that's not Vincent Price. He clearly like has lived his life as a bachelor, pining for the love of his life, who we find out had, she died the night before their wedding.
Right.
And just mysteriously passed away. And so he just basically, it sounded like he kind of gave up on life. Like he stuck to his professional work, and he seems like a pretty, you know, well-off guy. Right. But in his old age, you find out like he never loved another, like he just lived by himself as an old bachelor. And so there's this violent storm that kind of comes through, and they go out to visit the crypt. There's like a mausoleum on the grounds where the fiance had been buried, and they realize like her body, and this has been, I don't remember how many years have passed now.
Was like 30 something years.
Yeah,
it's been a long time.
Really long time. And her body is not a decayed corpse like it should be. It looks fresh and young and like she's sleeping. I mean, she almost looks alive.
Yeah.
And so they're puzzled. They're wondering how in the world, like, why is this? And they realize they've bought, there's water dripping through the crypt, and he's bottled some of this for whatever reason. And they feel like maybe there's something about this dripping water. There must be some, it's so pure that there's like actual life in this water, and it's restoring her to health.
Yeah.
So there's actually this pretty cool scene where they take a dropper of this water and drip it onto a dead, dried rose.
Right.
And the rose, like, becomes vibrant again. It looks like it's all nice and healthy, like a fresh cut rose. So they decide, well, we should try and drink this stuff. Like, we're old, we're at the end of our lives. So they both agree to drink the water. And miraculously, they're young again. Like, their gray hair turns brown and their wrinkles are gone. And there's some makeup work in there that's kind of comical. But you could tell from the very beginning of the movie, you're like, they're clearly making Vincent Price look older than he is here. What's going on? And then you realize, like, oh, it's so he could get young again. So anyhow, they get young again. And then they're like, well, we got to go wake up the fiance. If we're going to, you know, be young again, we're going to bring her back to life. And Vincent Price is kind of like, I don't know, this maybe not a great idea.
Yeah.
Which I think you had made the comment, like, normally Vincent Price is the one with the kooky ideas in the movie, right? And now he's the one kind of pumping the brakes, like, oh, maybe not the best idea. We don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So needless to say, they go ahead and revive the fiance. She comes back to life. They're, you know, she and Dr. Heidegger are going to get married now because they never got to before. And things sort of start unraveling from that point.
Yeah.
I'll let you take it from there.
Well, we come to find out Alex, played by Vincent Price, and Sylvia have had an illicit relationship for a long time that had turned very toxic. So toxic, in fact, that Alex poisoned Sylvia the night before her wedding, thus killing her and keeping this dark secret from his friend all these years. Unfortunately, they unhash this out loud so that Dr. Heidegger hears them. He comes down, confronts Alex. There's a struggle. Dr. Heidegger takes a knife to the stomach and dies, and you watch his body age, and then you see Alex's body age, And they turn around and look at the bride, who has now become a full-on corpse collapsing to the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And during their struggle, the bottle of life water had hit the ground, and there was no more of that to go around.
Isn't life water an actual, like, bottled water you can buy now? Life water is not paying for this segment of the podcast.
No. Unless they want to, and then we will gladly accept your funds.
Yes.
And he goes back out to the crypt, and of course it's not raining anymore, and this water is no longer available, and it just ends with grief and terribleness.
Yeah, but basically he's just going to have to live out the rest of his days now completely alone, right?
Yeah.
The fiancé's dead, and the best friend who he was trying to cheat out of a fiancé is dead.
Mm-hmm.
Sad.
And clearly over all these years, you know, he'd put that in his past, never told the doctor. And I think they had a genuine friendship.
No, they truly seemed, yeah, like they were buddies, but he's been keeping this a secret all these years.
So just to do a little homework, I went back and read Dr. Heidegger's experiment from the original Nathaniel Hawthorne short story. And it is a little less horrific. In the story, there's no one brought back from the dead. Instead, the doctor invites four of his friends over, three men and one woman.
Right.
And apparently, all three of these men at some point in their life had had a relationship with the lady. They turn young. They see this young, beautiful woman. Old feelings are rekindled. And they start fighting physically over her.
Right.
Unfortunately for them, the effects wear off. They age again, just like they do in the movie. And in this case, though, no one is dead. No one is murdered.
Right.
Instead, they decide to start looking for this fountain of youth because they've spilled this life water and need more of it. And they want a little more of that that good feeling of youth again. I thought that was a pretty cool story, but definitely not as gothic and grim as this one.
Right, right. Nathaniel Hawthorne usually is a bit of a morality tale kind of guy, right? And
yeah.
That sounds more in line with his ways.
Right. So for high fives, I'll get us started. And you got to give a high five to Vincent Price. I like how early on he plays a cautious, reluctant old man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, more of this posh, kind of silly character as an old man. Like, he just wants to drink with his buddy.
Yeah.
Be silly.
Just kind of sit around and relive the old times, right?
Yeah.
That seems to be what they do every evening, is enjoy, you know, expensive wines or port or something.
Mm-hmm.
And relive the old times, but not literally relive the old
times. Yeah. But then when he gets younger again and he sees Sylvia again and he gets those, I don't know, old carnal evil feelings again, the devil horns emerge and he starts behaving very differently and acting very differently, but effectively, all in a believable manner.
Right.
And you just wonder, like, you see people who've changed their ways over time,
mm-hmm.
but if you threw them back in time in that same circumstance in which they behaved poorly or badly,
right.
What would come out of them?
Do they lose all that wisdom?
Yeah, would they lose all the wisdom? Are they truly changed? You know, or
that's
they
interesting.
Slip back into it? So it's just kind of, it was kind of cool. And, mm-hmm. you know, only an actor like Vincent Price, I think, could pull that off.
Yeah. So I'll go ahead and second your high five with the other main character here. And that's Dr. Heidegger. I think his name was Carl in this. Carl Heidegger. That was played by Sebastian Cabot. Interesting fact, as we found out, I think you had mentioned, like, his voice is really familiar.
Yeah.
And then we, of course, upon some digging, realized he narrated Bagheera in Disney's The Jungle Book.
Yeah.
Like the old animated one. He's got that great, deep voice. Super great voice. He also narrated Sword in the Stone and several Winnie the Pooh stories, which I can, like, as soon as you said, oh, he narrated Winnie the Pooh, I could hear that voice.
Yes.
You know, saying the Hundred Acre Woods.
Christopher Robbins.
Yes, yes. So that makes me just love this guy's character, or him as a person anyhow, just knowing that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, he also played Santa in a TV remake of Miracle on 34th Street. I forgot about that. So, man, this guy's just like...
And he's in an episode of The Twilight Zone where he kind of plays a devilish character.
Oh.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've seen... Have I seen that episode?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Me and our daughter watched it.
Okay. He's got this laundry list of roles that are just these lovable, likable guys.
Uh-huh.
And he's kind of that same character in this movie, really. Like,
when he's in there, you kind of want to sit down and have a drink with him and tell stories with him and listen to him talk.
He's got a, I don't know, like a cheerful old man face.
Yeah, he does.
And he's a little bit rounder. He kind of seems like a Santa sort of figure,
right.
Minus the beard and everything. But yeah, he's definitely a strong actor here. And I think, you know, he handled himself well. He made a good transition, but not an over-the-top transition from like that lovable guy who, you know, had just resigned himself to live his life as a bachelor because he lost the love of his life to he's overheard Vincent Price and the reanimated fiance retelling of their love triangle and, you know, what it all, and he's got to deal with those emotions. And he, I think he responded appropriately.
Yeah.
You know, like he was clearly upset, angry. He pulls a knife out, but you're like, can he go through with it? Cause he's not, this is not typical for his character. You know? But I thought he handled it really well.
Yeah, I agree. When he first comes down the steps and confronts Vincent Price, first he tries to play it kind of cool, but you can see like teary-eyed
You know,
expression on his face, and just he's trying to process his emotions and try to figure out what he's going to do next. Right.
He's not just in a blind rage. Like he's hurt and what do I do with this information?
And then he gets it, picks up a knife and he hears Vincent Price talking. And you can kind of see this rage hit him like, I can't stand the sound of your voice. You know, you lying cheat, you know?
And all these years you've been lying to me.
He even says something like, you know, what, you're going to tell me that you're going to ruin my life a second time? You ruined it the first time. And now that I'm young again, you're going to ruin it this time too. And
that was a great line.
Yeah. He comes at him. It's tough to see him get stabbed in the stomach.
Oh, I know. He was such a likable guy. But yeah, no. So high five to Sebastian Cabot as Carl Heidegger.
Yeah. No, I agree with that one 100%. As far as low points, I don't think Marie Blanchard, who plays Sylvia Ward, she just doesn't possess the same acting chops as these two male actors.
No, but we see so little of her. It's really hard to say, you know, like she just has that one scene really with Vincent Price where she's, you know, they're around the corner discussing the love that they once had at the expense of Dr. Heidegger.
Yeah.
And then she gets some screams in when they're fighting and he gets stabbed. And
yeah.
That's about it. Then she's a corpse again.
There was a scene that kind of made me wince, you know, where Price admits that he murdered Sylvia.
Yes, yes. I'm
and
glad you brought that up.
She processes it for like 3 seconds.
If that, yeah.
And looks past it almost immediately, only wanting to be reunited with Vincent Price.
Yeah, I'm like, this guy just told you that he murdered you on the night of your wedding. Now, granted, you were marrying the other guy out of spite, but you're okay with it? Like, you're ready to throw yourself back in his arms right now?
It just wasn't believable. I was just like, heck no.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
He killed you.
Yeah.
That's how you're going to
act? I don't care how much I love you. If I find out you killed me, we're probably going to have some issues.
Yeah. So I don't know how much of that's just dumb writing. And again, that's this stuff wasn't in the Hawthorne.
Right.
You know, it's really on the screenwriter. I don't know if it's just dumb writing and maybe... Or maybe better acting could have saved the writing. So I don't know how much of it falls on her, but that fell flat a little bit for me. That's really the only low point I would say for this first segment.
Yeah.
So tell us about Rappaccini's daughter.
Okay. Quick synopsis of Rappaccini's daughter. Basically, he's an old professor that lives secluded. Rappaccini lives secluded with his daughter, who is now of age. She's beautiful. She's rumored about the town. It seems like it's a university town that they're in. And so all the young university students talk about her, but like nobody's ever seen her because Rappaccini keeps her locked up in his little pseudo mansion, kind of manor house with a walled garden. Well, a new guy comes to town and happens to see her in the garden with Rappaccini. His the flat that he's renting while he's going to university overlooks this garden, and he's watching out there, and he sees all these weird exotic looking flowers. They're not normal ones, I guess you would see. And this is taking place in Italy, I should say.
Yeah.
You could probably guess that from the name Rappaccini. But anyhow, so he gets a glimpse of her. He's automatically smitten with her, loves her, begins to try and talk to her through the window and be able to come and meet her. And she's saying, no, 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 you can't, you can't, you can't. Well, he doesn't listen very well, and so he buys her flowers. He does talk to one of his science professors about who's Rappaccini, and the science professor warns him, like, no, this guy plays God. He's off the rails as far as the science community goes. Don't mess with him, and certainly don't mess with his daughter.
Right.
So he doesn't listen, of course, as most young blokes don't. And so he goes and buys some flowers, sneaks into the garden, introduces himself again and says, you know, know, basically like, we need to see each other. We need to go out dancing. We need to go, you know, whatever. And she's like, no, no, no. And she clearly is like always backing away from him. You cannot, she's like, you cannot touch me. You cannot touch me. So eventually it has to come out that her father has been, so her mother left her father shortly after she was born, and he was heartbroken and bitter. Yeah. And so he decided he was going to make his daughter basically
untouchable
for the rest. Like, she could never cheat on anyone else, and no one can ever cheat with her because she is going to cause death with her very touch.
Yep.
So he's been like inoculating her with poisons from these exotic plants her whole life.
Mm-hmm.
They're so poisonous that Vincent Price's character, which is who's he's playing Rappaccini, he can't even touch his own daughter. He's wearing like leather gloves. He can't mm-hmm. touch the plants that he uses to make the poisons with. Everything is super poisonous. And even mm-hmm. the one particular plant that's like the plant,
uh-huh.
he coughs and wheezes. He can barely even get around. And right. the daughter has to start, you know, cutting the plant to make the, I guess she has to have like regular injections of this stuff.
Yeah.
And therein comes Amazon's label of drug use. So anyhow, it's very much a Romeo and Juliet tale.
Sure.
And I started reading the actual short story, and it plays out, the first few pages plays out very similarly to the movie.
Okay.
So I haven't finished it. Yeah. I don't know if it ends the same, but right. we know in the movie, basically he goes to the father, the young lover, he goes to the father and says, you know, you can't keep her like this. You got to set her free. And the father's like, well, I can't. Like, this is how she has to stay alive now. She has to have these poisons. And so he basically says, well, if my daughter wants this guy, I'll give her this guy. And neither one of them can ever cheat on her, each other, because he knocks the guy out and then injects him with the same poisons that the daughter has.
Mm-hmm.
So now they can touch each other, but they can't touch anyone else in the world without killing them.
Right.
So when the young lover comes to, he's real mad about this. He's not happy. Goes to his professor friend and tries to get the antidote, basically.
Right. Which proves to be deadly to
Fatal.
Them both.
Yep.
And kills them both. And then, of course, Vincent Price sees the death of the couple. And then he goes and grabs this deadly plant, you know, with no gloves on. And the deadly plant kills him. And
yes.
It all ends in tragedy.
Yeah, it all ends in very much a Romeo and Juliet type ending.
Oh, yeah. Well, for high fives, the first thing that really stands out in this segment is the garden scenery is just gorgeous.
It is beautiful. The color is so saturated in this film.
Yeah, it really comes out in the cinematography. Overall, in the whole film, I think the cinematography is nice, but it really pops in this section because mm-hmm. of all the beautiful colors, and it just pops right off the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And I was even commenting that newer films just don't do that for whatever reason.
No.
They don't have that kind of contrast of colors.
And right. Exactly. I was just about to say, I think it's the contrast, because you get those muted tones of those old buildings, and mm-hmm. and then you have these pops of vivid colors, whether it's in the costuming or the greenery,
mm-hmm.
you know, tapestries, that sort of thing. It's a real mix, I think, that makes it look so nice.
Yeah. Another high five I'll throw out there is Vincent Price as Rappaccini. You know, he plays a good, demented, bitter old man.
He's got the corner on that market.
He does. He's been blinded by his grief. And, you know, if anybody could sell this story, it's Vincent Price.
Right.
Because who puts poison in their little daughter that they love? Yeah. Sometimes their little girl, you know, who would do that?
It's just like creepy old Vincent Price.
Vincent Price would do that. and as far as low points, I mean, I have to say overall, this is the weaker of the three.
I think so, yeah.
It's kind of tedious to sit mm-hmm. through, I think. When the whole, like, Beatrice is trying to convince Giovanni to stay away. Like, that just seems to be so much of it. Like, stay away, stay away. We've already seen, like, mm-hmm. as the viewer, we know that she can't be touched.
Right.
But it's just like, all right, we get it. You know, you don't want to tell him this awful truth, but you already shown us 10 minutes ago. So will you please, let's move the story along.
Tell the guy.
So it's kind of rough just to sit through. I mean, it's not terrible, but it's, mm-hmm. you know, a little monotonous. And you didn't like the Romeo and Juliet characters as much, right?
No, well, you know, it is a short story, and we're getting, you know, 1/3 of a movie to tell the story. So there's just not a lot of, like, the guy looks out the window, he's smitten with her automatically. Like, it's just mm-hmm. very, but you don't get any of the Shakespearean dialogue with it. So it's very much like, okay, sure, he just fell in love with her automatically and has to be with her now.
Yeah.
Even though she's got these creepy, weird secrets and,
yeah,
you know. And also, like, there's a disconnect. I get it. You should not be injected with poisons against your will.
Yeah.
But it was like, why would you jump from, I wake up, I find out he's injected me with poison, now I can actually touch this girl that I love and marry her. Mm-hmm. I understand you being mad about that. But why do you jump from that to, let me go try out an untested poison on myself from this other guy?
Yeah. You know? Why don't you spend a little time holding this woman that you've been talking about?
If you're so smitten with her.
Yeah.
Like, let's at least maybe hug her give once. This some time. Yeah.
Show us one smooch at least. Come
Is
on.
Is it really that bad to be, you know, inoculated with this? I mean, maybe this guy's really afraid of commitment. That's what it is. He's got commitment issues, and this is not going to work for him.
It was all about the chase.
Yeah, it was. It was all about the chase, and now that's over.
Well, two, I think the acting from these two was a bit subpar. And they have a lot of screen time. So Vincent Price is clearly a way better actor than these two.
Yeah, we don't see a ton of him here
in
this story.
They get the lion's share of the screen time, and it's just, you know, for them to be kind of flat, kind of subpar.
Yeah.
It's a long time to have to be, you know, working through that.
For sure.
Then that takes us to House of the Seven Gables. So tell us about that one.
Yeah, so this one actually has the most convoluted story and probably left me with the most questions. But basically, Vincent Price's character is Gerald Pynchon. He returns to his family house after an absence of like 17 years, and he brings his new wife, Alice, with him. She seems to be rather reluctantly his wife. So his sister Hannah has been living in the house. She tells Alice about a curse that's been put upon the Pynchon men by Matthew Maul, mm-hmm. who used to own the house, but lost it in some shady deal to the Pynchon family. They've cheated him out of his house and his land, mm-hmm. right? So Jonathan Maul, not the original Maul, Matthew Maul, he's a descendant of Matthew. He arrives, but he refuses Gerald's offer to give him the house in exchange for the location of a vault where we think valuable property deeds are stored. Mm-hmm. So basically Price wants the descendant of this family that they've always had a feud with to help him find some pretty priceless information.
Yeah.
Right. So Alice, the wife, becomes haunted by the curse on the house that kind of eventually leads her down to the cellar, which somehow convinces Vincent Price and his sister that, oh, the cellar, that's where we got to look for things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Gerald finds her there. He uncovers a square on the floor, which happens to be the burial vault of Matthew Maul. In the vault, there's a map to mm-hmm. wherever this treasure is supposed to be hidden. So he decides to kill Hannah, the sister, while he's down there because he doesn't want to share the treasure with Hannah.
Mm-hmm.
And Alice, the wife, freaks out, so he slaps her around, knocks her out, throws her into the vault with the skeleton,
mm-hmm.
and then he is off.
Kind of buries her alive.
Yeah, basically buries her. He kind of drops the concrete slab back on top of her, and we see it crush her hand, and there's like some blood coming out there. So he goes off to figure out where the vault with the money or the deeds or whatever is.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the room that we originally started in the movie where his sister had told him, like, this is the chair where all the men in our family have died, you know.
Uh-huh.
So he gets there, he follows the map that he'd found, he opens the vault, and inside the vault is one skeletal hand reaches out and grabs him by the throat, pins him to the chair, the quote-unquote death chair.
Yeah.
And begins to strangle him.
Right.
And that seems like a fitting end for this guy who clearly is pretty dastardly and wants to continue the family tradition of corruption.
Yes.
But it's not over because Jonathan Maul comes back to the house because he knows something's wrong with Alice. Something has gone wrong.
He kind of gets a tip from his ancestor.
Yes. There's a lot of like ghostly
influence happening.
Yeah, influence. Tips in this.
So he runs down to the cellar, figures out that she's down there while the house is like imploding on itself.
Yeah. Not only is the skeleton hand like strangling Vincent Price's character, Gerald, but the house starts shaking like it's in an earthquake.
Yeah.
It's like crumbling.
Yeah. But he gets out just in time with this newfound love.
Yeah, he gets Alice out of the vault. She's not dead. She just has, you know, probably a crushed wrist.
Yeah.
Probably not going to be able to use that hand anymore, but he does get her out alive.
Yeah. You know, of the three, I think this one was a pretty strong entry, right? I thought so.
Yeah, there was definitely a lot more going on in this story.
Yeah.
It was a little hard to follow, but there was more depth to it, for
sure. Yeah, more depth, and I think overall the creep factor was high with this one. When I think of just kind of creepy Vincent Price movies, this is one. Like, it had human possession, it had a family curse, it had the dead wanting their revenge,
yeah,
a haunted house. Like, all those make for good creep factor.
Yeah. It kind of had a little bit of everything.
But the first high five I'll give is to the actress that played Alice Pynchon. Beverly Garland is her name. Okay. I felt like she kind of stole the show in this one.
Yeah.
So, you know, the last two stories, I kind of felt like the female leads had let their male leads down a little bit.
Right.
In their acting performance. And in this one, though, she is dynamite.
I agree.
She steals the show. We see the movie from her lens, really, because everybody else in the House of the Seven Gables is kind of crazy acting, you know?
And despicable people.
Yeah, they're
like,
all
even
nasty.
The sister is real shady and just mean acting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just hateful, like, just nasty people. And this girl seems kind and genuine. You know, you're seeing this nasty house, this creepy place, and you're kind of seeing it through her eyes. So as things that are shocking, that would be shocking to you or I, we're seeing it through, you know, through her perspective. And,
right. I would like to know how she ended up with Gerald, Vincent Price's character, to begin with. Because she's clearly young and blonde and beautiful and kind at heart. And how she ended up with this very greedy, disturbed man, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you know, like you mentioned, she's beautiful. She kind of has a timeless beauty. It reminds me of Victoria from The Corpse Bride.
Oh, yeah.
Because she's got those big, gigantic eyes, those high cheekbones, that kind of, you know, her head shape kind of comes down. I forget what they call that shape.
I wish the audience could see your motioning around your face.
What do you call that shape?
I don't know. What, a heart-shaped face?
Maybe.
I don't know what you're going
for. It's like a heart-shaped face. Yeah, yes. That's good. Yeah, you know, so much of the acting is just with her face, you know, even just without
that's
using
true.
Words.
Yes.
So, a very talented actress, great performance.
So, let's talk about Vincent Price. We know who Vincent Price is. We're very accustomed to his acting and his style. I'd say out of the three short stories in this film, this is, like, he's at his nastiest now.
Yeah.
You know, he's just low down and dirty. Like, he doesn't care that his family cheated this other family out of their possessions, their land. You know, they even murdered somebody to get all of this stuff. He doesn't care. I don't know why he's been gone 17 years and he decided to come back, but he is definitely the guy who's going to get the money. And he doesn't really care about the house or the property anymore. He just knows that there's deeds or some sort of paperwork in this house that's worth maybe millions.
Well, I guess they explain it a little bit that they had a family fortune and that he had squandered it somehow. He'd spent it all.
Oh, I missed
so
that.
So the funds are gone, and so he's back for more.
Oh, so he really is. Like, he's the prodigal son that did not return home for the right reasons.
No. He's desperate for more cash, and he's really nasty. Like you mentioned, he murdered his own sister with a sharp pickaxe right to the forehead.
Which I will say, I mean, we could save that for low points, but if you're going to murder someone with a pickaxe, you know, I will say kudos to this because I don't like graphic horror. So you don't see a pickaxe landing in someone's skull. Thank God. I'm glad I didn't see that. But you do see the sister kind of rebound, like fall away from the pickaxe swing. And she literally has like the tiniest, like I've seen our children's head bleed more than that.
Yeah.
From running into walls or something. Yeah. You know, like it's like the tiniest scratch. And I'm like, that's what a pickaxe did.
Yeah.
And you're dead now. Like you're barely bleeding.
It's not realistic. It's definitely, like we said, it's barely PG, how they did
it.
So it is kind of shocking. Like, oh, you just killed your sister with a pickaxe.
Exactly. Still, like, he's clearly showing us how awful of a human he is. Mm-hmm. And then he's, you know, just done with his wife. Like, she's screaming because she saw him murder his sister with a pickaxe. And so he's like, nope, shut up. You got to get out of here too. Knocks her around until she, I don't know, faints, passes out.
Yeah.
Blacks out.
Clearly doesn't love her.
No.
This is all about the money.
This is all about the money. So this is Vincent Price at his dirtiest.
Yeah. He definitely seems more comfortable doing this kind of stuff, too.
He does. He does. What's the one we've seen? It's another Vincent Price movie where it's like all the Shakespearean...
Oh, Theater of Blood.
Oh, yeah. This reminded me, like, this piece of this, you know, this story in this movie reminded me most of his Theater of Blood. Because that's all about revenge.
Yeah.
That whole movie's all about revenge. And he's very dastardly and evil in that, too.
No, I like it. I like it. I mean, you know, when you're watching Vincent Price, this is kind of what you expect.
Yeah, this is what we've come to expect, for and sure.
Another high five I'll throw out there, and this is for the film overall, is the musical score. There's this motif that keeps being played, and it's usually whenever something magical or mystical happens, but it's highly reminiscent of the Sinbad films. So I don't know if that was on accident or on purpose, you know, but either way, it was effective. It worked. The orchestral arrangements really worked nicely. I felt like the film was supported, you know, really effectively through the music. So
for sure.
High five for the musical score. So yeah, let's transition to low points. The first one is just kind of comical, but the blood is just so fake. And the skeletons that you see are really silly.
Yeah, yeah. That was going to be my mention, actually, for low points. Was all right. The blood is... And it's not just this movie, either. I think every Vincent Price movie we've seen that has blood involved in it...
Oh, no, even Hammer Horror films struggle with
it. That's true. Hammer Horror does this, too. It is straight-up red paint out of a can of paint. Like,
yeah.
It's not even... They're not even attempting to make it look like real blood.
No.
Like, have these people never bled before in their lives?
Yeah,
like,
really.
How do you not know that blood is not, like, Crayola red?
Right, right. Like, they're ready to paint a fire truck with this paint.
Yeah, and it's thick, you know. It looks like latex paint oozing out of a can, you know. So it's just very jarring because it looks so fake.
It does.
Not jarring in, like, oh, that's so gross, but jarring in, like, okay, that's not real blood. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's kind of silly looking.
Yeah.
And the skeleton, too, you mentioned. Like, the skeleton that was in the crypt in the cellar, or wasn't even a crypt, it was just buried under the cellar floor. That one was fine because it's just lying there.
Mm-hmm.
But the, I guess, sort of animated skeleton arm that ends up choking Vincent Price's character.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you could see the zip tie looking things that hold the carpal bones together in the wrist. You know, like it's from an anatomy lab, you know. And you could... It's like they didn't do a good enough job to camouflage that stuff. So it was a little like, okay, guys.
Yeah.
I can see how this thing is wired together.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's pretty silly. And we put it on our Instagram today of Vincent Price getting choked to death by this skeleton hand. And he's clearly like just holding it to his own throat, you know?
Right, right.
Doing his best to make it look like I'm trying to get away from this thing that I'm clearly pulling to my own throat.
Right, right. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But yeah. I mean, it leads to this other conversation we always ask, like, if you have a skeleton and you have muscles, you know, how does a skeleton defeat you?
Right, right. So my personal skeleton has muscles that make it robust and active and right.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah. How does it
how
overpower
does just
you?
Bones overpower?
I guess you just have to think, well, there's a ghostly force that's
whatever
pushing it.
Magic that's animating the skeleton must be stronger than the average human that has muscles and meat on its skeleton.
Yes.
You know, another low point I think we could mention is just this was the most convoluted story. It is confusing. Like, you really have to kind of work the pieces together yourself. And like, because there's so much going on. You've got all, if not all, many of the classic horror and gothic pieces in this story. So it is a little hard to figure out, like, who's mad at who? Wait, is she possessed right now? Who's she possessed by? We don't even know who that person is, you know?
Right.
So it's, the story gets a little muddy. And I think I have not read Nathaniel Hawthorne's House of the Seven Gables, but I have read a little synopsis of it. And I think this probably has taken a bit of a departure from the original story.
Okay.
So, and that may have been for time. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Trying to fit three stories into one movie.
Yeah. Well, they were definitely trying to go for like a creepy film. They were trying to replicate the tales of terror that was done the year before by another studio, and where they used Poe's source material.
Yeah. Which Poe is naturally creepier. Like, his storytelling is definitely creepier than Hawthorne storytelling.
So they took these Hawthorne stories and tried to make them even more gothic and more creepy. And, you know, for they did pretty well.
Yeah.
But I agree with the confusing piece. What really confused me is the budding relationship between Jonathan Maul.
Again, all these forced, fake, you know, romances that just come out of thin air.
Yeah. It's unclear, you know, is there some sort of reincarnation going on?
And he's calling her by the ancestor's name. He's calling Alice, the wife.
Mm-hmm.
The ghost calls her Nora and, like, draws her.
So maybe she's reincarnated, you know, or she has the spirit of Nora in her. But it's left to you to try to figure out.
Exactly. Yeah. We're never told exactly what all of that meant, for sure. A cool tidbit is that there is a real house known as the House of Seven Gables. And it was, I think, owned by Nathaniel Hawthorne's cousin or niece or somebody in the family. And it's still up in the Salem, Massachusetts area. It's like a, it's like a travel spot. You can go check it out even to this day. So if we ever make it to Massachusetts, I'd like to check it out.
Yeah.
It'd be pretty cool.
Well, you know, something else about Hawthorne, while we're doing a little research, one of his ancestors was one of the ones that actually put witches to death in the Salem witch trials.
Yeah.
And he was one of the only, maybe not the only, but one of the few that did it unrepentantly.
Ooh.
They never looked back in their old age and said, hey, you know, we missed the boat on that. Like,
wow. Yikes.
He was unrepentant and said, no, that was for the good of mankind that we did this.
He was okay with murdering a bunch of women.
Yeah. So Hawthorne, it inspired a lot of his writings.
Yeah.
To deal with that kind of morality, you know, good versus evil.
Well, and really when morality goes too far or like misses the mark, I mean, that's definitely Scarlet Letter. You see a lot of that.
Yeah, for sure. So final summations, what say ye, Kim?
Can I use the meh category?
Sure.
Again, we used that, I don't know, several weeks ago. But I think if this were on, you know, around, say, like Halloween time, it's got a fun little ambiance to it. You know, like if it were just playing and I had nothing else going on, I'd probably watch it just for, you know, the feels.
Yeah. Yeah.
A little chill in the air in October, November, maybe. But it's not something that I have to watch again or I need to watch again.
Right.
You know. It was fine. I honestly would rather read the Hawthorne story, so.
Yeah. Yeah, it's similar to another movie we watched earlier, and I can't remember which one it was, but it was one we talked about. It would be a good one to be playing during Halloween in the background.
Oh, yeah. What movie was that?
Or if you had a party and you just wanted this creepy Vincent Price movie in the background. It doesn't really matter if you're listening to it or not.
Exactly. It just lends itself to the moment.
Yeah. Right? It feels very much like a Halloween movie. So I like it. You know, I enjoyed it. You know, I enjoy those types of things. But as far as a piece of work or piece of art on its own, it's a little yay.
A
little yay.
Not a big yay, just a little yay.
Exactly. But yeah, on our social media, we got one comment from HorrorNESFreak24601. He said, not the best Vincent Price film, but still a great film. Definitely one worth checking out.
Cool.
We are getting closer to episode 20.
Yes, you know what that means. We get to take a break?
Yeah, we take a break. Well, there's something I haven't told you yet, but uh-oh. I think it's you're going to get a bonus 21st episode.
What?
So we're going to do 20 films. We obligated ourselves. We're going to do 20 film reviews.
In this first season.
First season.
Sure.
But then in episode 21, I want to do kind of like an Oscar style, like where we give awards for, you know, the whatever, best actor.
Oh, okay.
You know, that kind of thing. Best music. Season one Oscars.
Go. Season one attackies. I don't know.
Yeah. We need to think of a clever name for that. But we'll have like five nominees for each category. And
all right, that sounds fun. All right.
So that'll be a bonus 21st episode for season one.
I can do that.
So what are we reviewing next week?
So next week, we're switching it up. We're going comedy, but horror, monster movie. We're doing the 1974 Young Frankenstein with Gene Wilder.
Yay! Which,
yes, it's going to be fun. We're big Gene Wilder fans. Anyhow, he's hilarious. I saw this has a 94% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh,
I think a lot of people love this movie.
Oh, yeah.
I know we love this movie. So
Mel Brooks.
Yeah. Just some great funny.
Madeline Kahn, Terry Garr.
What a cast.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's rated PG. It's got like almost the highest rankings you can get on Rotten Tomatoes. Like this should just be a fun watch for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't seen this in years and years and years, but I have high hopes for it.
Yes. Yeah. I think we'll enjoy it. Yep. And I think it's available on Hulu. If you have a Hulu subscription, we happen to own this movie. So that's how we will be watching it.
All right. Well, everybody have a great week.
Enjoy your movie watching.
Peace out.
Peace out.